Okay, folks. Hey, welcome to the We Haven't Named This Podcast Yet. I suppose we. Well, Jim, how many episodes of Dragging Up the Past did we get through before we came up with a name for that?
Oh, heavens. I'm guessing we were probably about three in.
Yeah, three or four in before we came. So we'll name this podcast at some point or another. But yeah, there's a couple of faces you will recognize or voices you will recognize and a couple you might not. But for tonight, obviously, we have our good buddy Jim. Cyrano is back with us. And we have a podcast rookie with us tonight. We have Steven with us. Hello, Steven.
Hello.
Yeah. And new location to find us on the web. Those of you that have followed us from elsewhere, we are now over at armchairdragoons.com. So we are riding to battle in style. And if you dig our dragoon lounging in his armchair saddle, it was Jim's lovely wife who came up with our cool primary t-shirt graphic there. And so give your wife an extra hug for us for that one.
I assuredly will.
Because if the rest of us start hugging her, it's going to look a little weird.
Yep.
Yeah, and we don't need to incur your wrath because you have a badge. And
I do.
Yeah. So
it's a very little one, but a badge nonetheless.
Yes. So yeah, armchairdragoons.com. Come over and check it out, and we will start rolling out some further discussion of the kinds of things we are planning over there, some of the nifty stuff that we're wanting to do, and as we get it ready, the podcast is certainly one of the places we'll talk about it. But tonight, let's just talk some game stuff, and so normally, you know, instead of just what did you play last week, it's been a couple of months since we've had this discussion, and so I know Steven's answer, I'm pretty sure, because I was there. But Jim, what did you most recently play?
Most recently, I played, some friends came up for my birthday weekend a week late, and so we rolled out a couple of games. I had the opportunity to really sink into Napoleon 1806 by Shaco's, a French company. It's a treatment. I know everybody's going to be surprised of the Anna Auerstedt campaign of 1806.
Yeah, whoever thought you would have been playing that one.
Right, and I'm going to be spent a lot of time with it, and I put some words to digital paper and sent them along to Armchair Dragoon, so my review of that game is going to be coming up, not the too terribly distant future, but I'm not the editor, so I'll let him talk. But I did send that in, and I got to sit down and run through that with both my son, who is my regular gaming companion, as well as my friends. But I also, my big game, I guess, over the weekend was we laid out on the table, had some friends, and I haven't seen, like I say, I hadn't seen these fellows in a while, and so we set out Commands and Colors Napoleonics, the epic Aspern Essling scenario from the spring of 1809, and we had a chance to sit down and work through that. The thing about it, Commands and Colors has this reputation for being this really quick, snappy, short game, and it is. Except when it gets epic.
I was going to say, it is when you don't have like 68 blocks per side.
Right, and that's the thing. It always kills me because, as you well know, you know, when we've been at Origins and we've been running games for kids, I use Commands and Colors Ancients with kids. I mean, I've taught it to 5-year-olds and 6-year-olds with no problem, and we clip through it, and pieces fly all over the place. We throw some dice, and yay, we cheer, and then it's over, and we all have time still to get a soda. But my God, we started out at 11 o'clock when everybody showed up because my son had a soccer game Sunday morning, and we went through, I don't think anybody got out of there before 9 o'clock. So there was a lot of talking and dinner, and we ate on the run and all that stuff. But that game just gets suddenly long when everybody can really tuck into it. But it's great. It's the best way to play Commands and Colors Napoleonics. I really don't – I think the other version of it is inferior, to be blunt. I love playing it that way. And then the other game we decided to play together was Black Orchestra. This is more of a Euro game, although it's certainly got a big historical theme. It's for those who are of a certain age, you will remember a game by SPI, The Plot to Assassinate Hitler.
Yep.
It was a very strange game, especially since this was in the day before hobby board gaming existed. And it was almost like a cry in the dark of, hey, you know, war games don't just have to be hex maps and chits that move at movement rates with factors. It was a different thing. This is, in some respects, the latest iteration of that. I've also called it, if you've ever watched the documentary Hitler's Bodyguard, it's Hitler's Bodyguard, the board game.
Yeah.
And it's a brilliant design. You're obviously trying to kill Hitler. You represent one of the individuals who participated in the resistance to Hitler, whether it be Stauffenberg in the military or some of the folks on the religious side or some of the folks on the academic side, the political side. And it's a cooperative game, everybody against the system. And the core mechanic is the more Hitler is popular, the more his military succeeds, the harder it is to kill him. And so there are these wonderfully torturous moments in the game of – and you have to coordinate everything. You've got to get the tools for the assassination. You've got to pick the type of assassination. You've got to get Hitler to the location with the assassination. And running all over the board are his five henchmen, each of whom has a different ability. For example, Joseph Goebbels has the ability to – you know, he will talk you out of – he lowers your motivation level. You know, you don't necessarily want to kill Hitler. He talks you out of it. And so there's all these wonderful mechanics going on. And the bottom line is it's a push-me-pull-you, because as you get closer and closer and closer, suddenly Hitler has a success. And now it's harder to kill him, and you don't feel like you can do it because you've got to stand up and do it. And all along you're afraid the Gestapo is going to sweep in and arrest one of you. My two favorite mechanics, bar none, when the Gestapo catches you, you draw from a deck of cards, you draw a card, and you can't show it to anyone else. Okay. And you have to decide what you're going to do to get out of Gestapo custody. And every card is different. And you can betray somebody. You can try to tough it out and sustain torture. And everybody else is looking at you like, what did you do? And obviously you can't tell them. And the other big mechanic is the exciting moment where you actually try to pull the trigger and kill him. Unfortunately, despite having tried four times, we are 0-for against Der Fuhrer. He continues to live, but it's a spectacular game. Loved it a lot. And Black Orchestra, by the way, is the term the Gestapo used to describe the various resistance groups. So for a non-hardcore war game, it's still a terrific choice. We had a lot of fun with both those just this weekend.
You mentioned the discussion of 1806. By the time anybody's listening to this, it is already on the website.
Oh, very good.
So, and that's more an estimation of when I'm actually going to get around to editing this than anything. that's the greater assessment of the reality there, because I'm not editing this together tomorrow morning.
Fair.
So, Stephen, unless you've played something since lunch yesterday, I think you and I have the same answer to what did you play most recently.
From a board game perspective, that's correct.
Yeah. So there's a group of folks that used to work together at a defense contractor going on about 8 years ago now that we were all there together, although Stephen managed to hang on a lot longer than the rest of us around there. and we still get together on a regular basis. It's the core of my lunchtime gaming group that I've talked about on other podcasts before. And so we pulled out Kingdom Builder. Again, one of the key things that we've got in this, we end up with a lot of Euro games because you've got to be able to play something in the hour that everybody has available for lunch. So it's got to be something that fits in that hour. And so we did Kingdom Builder, the area control movement, not a lot of movement, but the area control game where you're trying to get your settlements built. You're using a hex map, so it is a board with hexes. But you've got a card that tells you which terrain you're building on that turn, and then depending on which locations you capture, you get to add some special abilities each turn. And it's been around for, you know, half a decade at least. And fun little game. Stephen, you mentioned tabletop, so there was something digital in between.
Yeah, I do. I mean, I still, on occasion, actually like to jump onto Minecraft and tool around and look for villages to do stuff to. And I'm playing Fortnite a lot with my kids, which is a lot of fun.
Okay. So who's the better Fortnite player?
probably my oldest son.
Yeah.
He's still the champ on that one, yeah. Still a lot better than me. And I enjoy it because we can get on and play squads. So the four of us, myself and my three kids, will jump on. And so I get to tag along and point people out once I've been killed. Yeah, that's a lot of fun. It's a good way, and it allows us also to jump on with my daughter, who's up in Pittsburgh. So it's a good time.
Does she regularly beat up on you guys?
No, she doesn't play that one as much. So we still, when she joins, she's probably a little better than I am. But the guys pretty much take it away. So
yeah, my son was pretty hardcore into Fortnite there for a while, and was up in like the top 5% or so ranked nationally, however they end up ranking those things online. But then they released a new update for Destiny 2. And so Fortnite got kicked to the curb.
That was the end of that.
Yep. Fortnite was a mere temporary distraction until a new Destiny 2 release came out. So.
Yeah. So back to the Kingdom Builder, though, that was my first time playing. And even with going over the rules and such with me, we still got through it pretty quickly. So it was a fun, fast-paced game, and seems like there's enough change to it that it would be quite different every time.
Oh yeah, absolutely. The and we were just using the base game. We weren't using any of the expansions, of which there's four, I think, at this point. Jim, have you ever played that one? I know it's a Euro, so probably not. I'm teasing.
Well, the first question is, does Napoleon appear anywhere in it?
He could, should you choose to use one of the wooden blocks to be Napoleon. So,
so I can pretend one of the blocks is Napoleon.
Sure, if you want to.
But no, I have heard of this. This is Kingdom Builder,
correct?
By Queen Games?
Yes, that's the one.
I'm just taking a peek at it here. Very good.
Yeah.
I've heard of it. Never played.
Yeah, you put four maps together, four geomorphic hex maps together, out of about 12 or so that come in the box. Each one has a mixture of some special locations on there and a couple of just point-scoring cities. The special locations are... there's a barn, there's a paddock, there's the tower, there's the dock, the boat. And so if you place one of your settlements adjacent to one of those special locations, then you add that special ability to what you can do each turn. Otherwise, you draw a card each turn, and you get to play your settlements on the terrain indicated on that card. And the challenge to it all is they have to be contiguous to existing settlements, if at all possible. And so there's a lot of area management, not just area control, but sort of managing where you put your pieces so that you don't box yourself into too tight of a hole that you cut down on the options you have for where you can play. And that ends up being part of the challenge. And so there's about 12 different maps, you only ever using four at a time, so those swap in and out. There's also about a dozen or so different scoring cards, and you use three in each game. And so depending on the scoring cards you're using, sometimes the ones we had the other night or the other day at lunch, you were trying to connect the locations, so to draw a contiguous line of your settlements from one location to another. You needed to, the hermits, you wanted as many discrete separate blocks of settlements as possible. And the lords, you wanted more of your settlements on any one of the four boards than anybody else had on that board. And so you swap the different scoring conditions in and out. So, Stephen, you're right. There is a lot of replay value in a single box.
Yeah, it sure seemed like it. Yeah.
Jim, I'm curious how much further, if at all, you guys have gotten in the great conquest of Gloomhaven.
The thing with Gloomhaven, for those who haven't played it, is, and we both saw this at Origins this year, there's a company, Broken Token, from whom I purchased my prodigious dice tower. and, you know, the absurdly large three-level dice tower. which I love, but is not as practical as I might have hoped.
I will tell you that at only three levels, it is far more practical than what we had originally described to each other at Origins, which we will circle back around to here in a moment.
So despite that, the same company, the Broken Token, they provide an organizer for Gloomhaven that costs almost as much as the game at retail. But if you've played enough Gloomhaven, you understand why it's worth every penny you pay. Because while Gloomhaven itself is not actually a complicated game, the combat system is a simple card deck. The maps themselves are not huge. They're, you know, the maps we're all expecting for the fantasy trip, yay, are actually much bigger. And they're little tactical scenarios. The problem is getting them out and organizing them and then setting everything up is a bear, which has really limited the number of times. I would say we've had it out six times since we just let it sit and let it be part of it. We have gotten past a couple of retirements, and so we're going to see how those go. And it is an incredibly well-told story. And the thing about it is, and the best way I've tried to describe it to other people, because the big debate I get into with people, or the discussion, because I'm on both sides of it, so I guess I really can't debate very well.
You're arguing against yourself, huh?
Right, I wind up arguing against myself.
Do you win?
I let myself win because I'm tragic. But I said one time, why am I doing this if I could just as easily play Savage Worlds or First Edition Advanced Dungeons & Dragons or games I truly love and have loved for decades? And part of the reason, and it's only a part, because Gloomhaven has merits all of its own, is this incredible joy of discovery that is shared by my family. This is the one game that my wife will not let me play with other people. You can invite other people into your game. We could play it with when my friends came over, they were very curious about it. They had heard about it. And her attitude is, no, that's my box. That is my story. I want to see my story unfold. and that story is really, really good. And it comes with a lot of, uh-oh, you did this thing. Open that box. and you go into it, and it's something cool, or it's something, oh, I really did not want that. And so it keeps for drawing us back in. It is, you know, in a walk, the greatest, the best non-war game board game of this generation. It's got something for war gamers. It's got something for board gamers. So to answer your question, this long and circuitous route, if we were scoring this like they do PC games, my guess is I would say, it seems to me that the fullness of Gloomhaven is nigh infinite, but from a true playthrough, I would call us at about 14%.
Yeah. So for those folks like Steven probably scratching his head, Gloomhaven, one of the newfangled legacy games where decisions you make earlier in the game effectively open or close certain doors for you later in the game. So it's sort of a choose your own adventure that you can't back up, you know? And so like Jim was saying, you know, when you make a decision that says, go open this pack of cards, well, you haven't opened that pack of cards yet to see what's in there. And so there's, it's sort of Schrodinger's cards, right? You don't know if they're good or bad.
And they're possibly both. Well, and the other thing is from both, and like I say, the retirement mechanism. Every player, you draw from a deck of life missions, and there's 52 of them, and they're related directly to something on the game. So it'll say, go to this location at some point in your life and do this thing, or defeat this kind of monster, or get this treasure. And when you do that, your character is done. The character you've played maybe for 20 adventures is finished and now gets inserted into another deck. And we haven't had it happen yet, but I know it happens. I've heard it. this character then that you built up and you personalized, because you can, with the card combat deck, you put little stickers on it to make it uniquely yours and all this really crazy stuff. This character, as you created them, comes back as an NPC. And now you interact with them. And depending on circumstances, they might hate you, they might fight you, they might help you for a mission. So suddenly this character that you mentally got in, I loved my very first character. I thought he was awesome. And the other thing they do, they don't necessarily go down the road of my beloved Tolkien fantasy tropes. They really put some effort into creating new races, new classes, yeah. New characters. So it's a lot of fun. And the other thing that impresses, it's a lot of game. So yeah, the legacy.
Well, yeah, it takes a forklift to move the box around.
Oh yeah, the only thing that comes close, or the only thing that it's competing with, is the ogre box. So no, it's the stuff, and people are still at it, punching through it. And I've not heard. I've seen enough people play it. I've read enough about it online. I've not heard any people that are saying, we're tired of this. So it's that there's something else that we just didn't want to see. And we're still, every time we finish playing and put the game away, we peek inside the box and say, ooh, I wonder what that is. No, so it is super, super cool. And it's particularly great because it's a definite one you can gather your family around and do.
I think
so.
Go ahead.
So it was my turn to do a little look up online, and the all-knowing Wikipedia says it's a branching story consisting of almost 100 scenarios. So.
Yeah, and that's just the base game. I mean, don't they have a couple of expansions out for it at this point?
Yeah, well, and it's true that they have that. Actually, I think there's more scenarios than that, it seems to me. But there's all sorts of little things that happen, because every time you go off and do a scenario, you also go back to Gloomhaven. And there's things that happen to you in Gloomhaven. And then when you go back out, there are things that happen to you on the road out. So, and some of them are really cool moral choices, frankly, which are some of which, at least the ones we've encountered, seem to be built to screw around with our concept of fantasy tropes. Mm. You know, one of them was, I don't want to do any spoilers, but it amounted to, this guy wants to play cards with you.
Okay, I'll tell you this, Jim. I am not buying Gloomhaven, so you can go ahead and spoil it, and you're not hurting my feelings.
you go out there, and your guy says, "Do you want to cheat? Do you want to cheat, or do you want to play fair, or do you want to refuse?" Now, my son, being my son, is like, "Well, of course we're going to cheat." Stupid. He's, I want his prize, and. Then I'm, you know, me being who I am, no, we are going to play fairly. And my wife, because this is who she is, wanted to say, no, we're not playing with this guy. It ends badly. And so I play fairly. I actually win. But because I win, we wind up getting ambushed by a bunch of bad guys.
Well, good for you.
You know, whereas if we had cheated, it would, I gather, it would have ended better for us.
Yeah.
You know, so they're into messing with you, and the writing is great. No, it's for all the money it costs and for all the organization and effort you put into it, you know, it's not the kind of thing you're throwing up at your workplace lunch table. That's for a fact.
Oh, no.
And, of course, the exciting thing to me is to see that there is apparently an upcoming release of Gloomhaven video game, which is loosely based on the board game.
Yeah, I'm so curious about that, because, boy, I guess I don't know. Part of the joy of the game is fooling around with your deck of cards.
Yeah, sure.
You know, you get to pick the cards that are in your deck and which ones aren't. The deck of cards function as your timer, because as the rounds go on, you get fewer and fewer cards, and if everybody's ever out of actions, the game, you lose the scenario. And so you're always husbanding those cards, and you're putting your special stickers on them, and it's very tactile, and the figures are really cool. I don't know. I mean, I'll certainly in a wait and see mode, but I would much rather fire up this new Pathfinder computer game that my buddy Jason is constantly having to play online for the benefit of corporate America.
Is that his cover story?
Well, no. I mean, he's the designer of Pathfinder.
Well, I know.
So he's, you know, so those who don't, you know, he's I follow him on Twitter. He's like, I'm going to play it again. It's like, they really got you lashed to the wheel, don't you, brother?
Oh, no, I must play another game.
Well, it's funny, and he admits this. There was a, he's talking about how the world has changed. There was a remarkable Twitch stream from Gen Con this year of him doing one of the Pathfinder 2nd Edition playtests live with a group of folks in front of a camera, and I'm sitting in the comfort and convenience of my own home here in Bruce City, watching my buddy Jason run this campaign, and he actually made the point. It's like, I'm tired. It's been a really, really long day, but I got to admit, I get paid for doing this.
So we just twist that needle a little more.
Well, he's given me the line. There are more men who have walked on the moon than make their living on a full time basis writing and selling RPGs. And as that is true, he has always been grateful for it. And I'm sure he has bad days, but it is pretty hard to go, well, I better get to the office and write some more games.
than have ever made a full-time living playing RPGs or that are currently doing
currently.
It?
Currently.
Currently, yeah, I'll ever. Believe. Ever, I'm not sure I'd buy.
I'm not sure I'd be curious. You would assume that high watermark is sometime in what, the late 80s, early 90s at TSR?
I would assume so, but keep in mind, too, are we just talking Americans? Because Games Workshop has covered a lot of people's paychecks over the years, working on the Warhammer franchises.
Yeah, but I'm talking about RPGs here, and I don't know if they ever had that many people on those.
Yeah, I don't know, maybe not. But yeah, I would think TSR at their heyday had a pretty substantial number of folks whose primary job it was to write and design there. So,
and now, a lot of those folks wound up getting paid in role-playing books.
Yeah, well, there was that. Hey, look, let's face it. We've talked to a handful of them on the show over the years.
We have.
On previous shows elsewhere, many of whom are still plugging away in the industry doing their thing. So that's... There are worse lives you could live than Matt Forbeck's, right? You know what I mean? So I remember Matt late last year put a thing out on Facebook. He's like, so in the past 12 months, I've had books released for Captain America, Halo, Star Wars, and I don't remember what the other one was, but he's like, you know, four beloved sci-fi franchises, and I got the, you know, fantasy sci-fi franchises, and I did them all in 1 year. I'm like, okay, we can go with that. Steve and Jim had mentioned playing some with his son, who I guess I met him when he was, what, 5 the first time he dragged me to Origins?
That would seem right.
Yeah. So how early did you start your kids, Steven?
I think the youngest was probably 6 or 7.
Yeah.
On the video game side. I mean, we've played board games and such, but on the video game side, it was probably with Halo.
Yeah. Yeah. The,
way back
when.
Yep.
When,
in fact, they used to jump in on some of the games back at the, defense contractor we were talking about. Yeah. When we jump on with the guys from there at night or whatever, they'd jump on and I'd just sit and laugh and watch them. Do their thing.
There was one night where we had a Wii set up there also. What we did was we plugged a Wii into one of the projectors in the office and we're projecting it into one of the, out in one of the common areas where we had this 10-foot high wall. And so a couple of the younger kids were out there doing Super Smash Brothers and Wii Golf and I think Mario Kart with a 10-foot high projector. And so you want to talk about a little bit of motion sickness when Mario Kart's, you know, bouncing off of ramps and stuff and it's near life size as you're watching it on the projector there. That was a good bit of fun, but it was right at the end of the night. Everybody else was bailing out. Steven and I were like the only two adults left and we handed my son a controller to join us for one of the Halo games. which was fine, which was all good and well until my, you know, 6-year-old son gets home and, hey, Mom, guess what? I got to play Halo with Dad at the office. And, yeah, and then I got my butt chewed. So, for letting my kid play a violent shooter game at a mere 6 years old. So.
No, it happens.
Yeah, of course, now that he's 15 and, you know, he's you know, one of the top-ranked players out there on Destiny, it's all cool. You know, he's just playing Destiny with his friends online. But at the time, yeah, there was a bit of a butt-chewing administered for letting the youngster run around and shoot people. He may have actually finished ahead of me in that game, too. So, not a hard challenge at the time. I was a pretty bad
player. I was going to say, that wasn't hard at the time, that wasn't hard.
No, 2 years and change. I finished first in one Halo game the entire time. So, yeah, that was entertaining. So, say so you got him started on Halo early. Was that just the boys, or did your daughter jump in too?
She jumped in too. She's the oldest, so she definitely jumped in and had a lot of fun with it.
Had to push the boys around some.
Yeah.
So.
And that, you know, they've, over the years, they've drifted more towards PC games. So that's kind of the mainstay now, although we do still pull out the Xbox and the PS4 and play various things. But mostly it's PC gaming right now.
What are they PC gaming their way through?
Various things, but Fortnite is a pretty strong go-to. Trying to think of what else right now.
So Fortnite on the PC, not Fortnite on one of the consoles.
Yeah. And the Battle Royale, not the other.
Yeah.
The other one. We did the beta of the other one.
Who's playing that? I suppose somebody must be. I have a very, very good friend who's an art director over at Fortnite, and one of the things I tease him about on Facebook on a regular basis is nobody's playing anything other but jump out of the bus and go shoot people game.
Yeah.
You know, I just don't believe people are playing it. I don't play it much because my son can't get it to work on his computer right at the moment. But when we were playing it, when it was working, I was always wondering who was in that other room. Who were those people sitting there all by themselves hoping somebody else would join them?
Probably those people trying to figure out how to play.
There you go. That I might accept.
Yeah, you could treat it as a bit of a training ground where you're just sort of learning what to do. So... that would be my guess.
I had a buddy that reached out to me and tried to get me to go back into it, and I was like, yeah, I haven't played that since the beta, but if you want to jump on the other one.
Slight change of topic here. Jim, has your Compass Games holiday catalog arrived yet?
No, I do not have my... It's out. So exciting. I got my... I did get my... OSG catalog somewhere, my operational studies group, Kevin Zucker, thank you. But I do not yet have my Compass Games. I am assuming by your comments that you have yours. Oh, very nice.
So for those that don't know, first of all, Compass Games, let me just say that it's a good thing I'm broke. Because if I wasn't, I'd have a whole lot more Compass Games and I'd still be broke. And let's face it, like many of us, I would have a whole lot more Compass Games that I probably wasn't playing, that I would be opening and fondling and going, ooh, I can't wait to play this, and then it would go back on the shelf in the hopes that one day I would find somebody to play them with me. but yes, the new Compass Games holiday catalog is here. They've printed it on the giant 18x24 sheet and then folded it like 16 times so that it fits in your mailbox. But yes, it is here. It is gorgeous. It even smells. It's got that new game smell, which is cool for a catalog. I swear they just have the map people print this and then fold it all up. they have to. But yeah, so here's my biggest problem. Folks that know me know that sort of my shtick is that Cold War goes hot. It's sort of post 1975 ground combat. That's my thing. That's what I love. That's what I enjoy doing. And so here's CSS Fold the Gap. Here's NATO Next War in Europe. Here's all these, you know, Compass Games has like five games coming out that you're like, oh my God, I need that one. Oh, I need that one too. Oh, I need that one also. I actually had a reserved copy of Under an Iron Sky in the latest reprint, and sadly had to let it go because I just don't have the money for it right now. That's a whole separate story with what health insurance is costing me at the moment. But at the time, I didn't know that when I put my name down for the pre-order. You want to talk about a game that was right up. I mean, those guys sat down and said, huh, what kind of game could we design to just completely ruin Brandt's life by not ever letting him get a hold of it and making him want it for the rest of it? Yeah, that was Under an Iron Sky, and I can't get the damn thing. And so what does Compass do? They say, hey, we're going to do them one better, and we're going to publish three or four games like that just to ruin Brandt's day. So yeah, that's what they're doing. They've got the Fold the Gap one out there. They've got NATO Next War in Europe. They've got a couple of other upcoming Cold War Goes Hot games. And damn it, I need to win the lottery. I need to win the lottery. That's what I've decided. I need to win the lottery. Either that, or I'm just going to go move into the Compass warehouse and hope that they don't notice the occasional game going missing.
He's living up in the rafters.
Yeah. Well, look, it's not like you and Doug haven't threatened to do that to Enterprise.
No, yeah, Don knows. Don knows that he's going to show up. Don, who owns Enterprise Games, longtime friend of the family, as it were, he must assuredly know that at some point his shop is not that far from Doug's house. And as a consequence, he knows we're just going to be there. We will bring scotch and snacks.
Yes, and cigars.
And cigars, so, well, not indoors because we'd set everything on fire.
Well, yeah, there's that.
You know, but we would certainly share them outdoors on the veranda if he has a veranda. Oh my God, they're doing Tank Leader too.
Yeah, they've got a Third World War reprint coming. They've got Hearts and Minds has been out for a while, but they've got a Vietnam reprint coming. Adam Starkweather's doing Vietnam. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, they're I just got in the mail my copy of Commands and Colors Tricorn, the French expansion that I'm hosing around with. So they got that, and it's mighty pretty, and that's the other thing. Whatever I might think, cuz I haven't loved all their releases in my wheelhouse, but I will say they sure do pretty, pretty games.
Yeah. Yeah, no, absolutely. I will say this for Compass Games, a lot of people are probably going, what the hell are they still printing paper catalogs for? I love the paper catalog. Compass, don't ever stop printing paper catalogs.
And look, folks, I'll answer that question in a minute. They're catering to their audience.
Oh, hell yeah.
Did you see my rant? It was a mini rant. It was just a one-sentence rant about the new game from Volker Runke.
No, I don't think I did, actually. Lay it on us. And even if I had, that doesn't mean the audience did. So lay it on us.
Yeah, I understand what GMT is doing. I do. I or at least I think I do. Because
paying bills?
Stop it. I don't fear at any level that they're suddenly going to go out of business. I just don't think that's true. You know, I think that Twilight Struggle alone is enough to keep them in GMT mugs and the appropriate artwork well into the next life of ours. Why?
Especially at the rate Katie's promoting it.
Well, yeah. I mean, she's out there, and God bless her. You know, she's and you know, I've got a lot of thought. You know, we've talked about this. This is something I want to write about at some length once I can get my thoughts around it and get the time. But the gaming is changing, and GMT is right on the edge of this. You know, they are putting out games that are not traditional war games. They do not want to be in the deep end of the pool the way Compass clearly still does. I mean, you know, some of these games, I look at them and go, ooh, that actually sounds intimidating.
Yeah.
you know, it's like I'm looking at the Korean Fire and Ice game. I'm looking at their Vietnam game you're mentioning. These are these are some chunky, chewy games. On the other hand, the latest game from Volker Runke and GMT on the P500, orders to date 256, Mystery Wizard.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I want to punch something. This honestly makes me angry. And look, it's a company. It's their company, not mine. I don't own a company. And they have been very successful. I've never been successful with this sort of thing. So, yes, I'm an idiot. I admit it. But, you know, don't, you know, I've got it. Oh, here it is. On a hexed isle, far across a shining sea, wizards duel for magical supremacy and the fate of the island itself.
Yeah.
This is coming from GMT. And do what you're going to do, guys. I will buy your games. That's not a question. But this is going to be in a line in front of games I want. It is a fact that Richard Borg has Command and Color Napoleonic scenarios ready to come out, and they're sitting behind Mystery Wizard.
Well, you know, here's the other thing. Yeah, that may be frustrating to you. Volko clearly has a relationship with GMT that allows him to bring a game like that to GMT where they're going to want to run with it, especially after the litany of hits he's already handed them with the Coin series and Wilderness War before that. But how you could add up the Fab series, not just any one title in the Fab series. You could add up the Fab series through multiple reprints. I bet they sell more copies of Mystery Wizard first edition printing than they do of the entire Fab series in all of its printings.
I don't have to like it. I'm allowed to whine. This is pointless whining on my part. I realize it. And I, as anyone can say, if you don't like Mystery Wizard, don't play it. Don't order it. Don't look at it. Spit when its name is mentioned. But the fact of the matter is, it's going to be made. Much like there are some folks that don't think coin games are war games, or they don't particularly care to play them. Other people, and I admit, I'm a complete heretic here. I'm completely geeked with Imperial Struggle. You know, this is Ananda Gupta's new game about, you know, the 18th century Imperial Struggles.
Yeah.
Most people don't find that to be a war game.
It's, you know, it's the Twilight Struggle of muskets.
It's Twilight, and you know how I feel about that.
Yes.
Twilight Struggle with muskets is two great tastes that taste great together. But at the same time, you've got this company that's coming out with that, that's also coming out with a game, Golden Gate Park.
Yeah.
You know, and, my point, I think, is made. They're clearly going in a different direction. Not entirely. They've still got wonderful, wonderful, good, crunchy war games here. But they're trying to diversify. And you know what? That sounds like what a sensible business would do. On the other hand, and I guess this is every fandom that's ever existed, but GMT Games, you were my stuff.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, you made my toys. I don't want you to make toys for those other people. They have toys.
Yeah.
You know, it's not like there aren't enough board games being released this year.
Yeah. Yeah. This week.
Right. And okay, I'll make a very particular point as one peruses the P500s. Pache, their republication of Command & Colors Napoleonic's games, which have been out for several years now, there are no new P500 Napoleonic games. Not one.
I think we all know what happened.
I'm listening.
No, I mean to Napoleon. I think we've already figured out what happens to him.
Oh, I see. That's how we're going to play this game. So we've had the end of World War II games.
Says the guy whose primary, you know, shtick is hypotheticals from a World War III that never happened. So,
right.
We don't know what happened there. So the lots to react to there, but I will throw a couple of things out, knowing full well that I've never, to my knowledge, directly spoken with any of the guys who make decisions at GMT. A couple of things. I mean, one, look, there's money to be made. And if there's money to be made, you might as well try to grab some of the money that's there to be made. And so that's smart business on their part. And it's hard to look, like we tell all the people that we work with at the game conventions over the years, you know, if it doesn't make business sense for you to be there, we're not going to try to browbeat you into showing up just so we have extra toys to play with as the GMs, right? You've got to make the business decision you think is the best call for you. And we're there to be your biggest cheerleaders about it all, and we're totally fine with that. We don't want anybody making a dumb decision just because it, you know, it's more fun for us at the game convention. So make your best business decisions. I totally get that. I would also completely understand the frustration of if GMT's only got 12 games they can send to the printer, and you could have had 12 crunchy Hex Encounter War games, only now you're only getting 8 because 4 of those slots are being taken up by Mystery Wizard, right, and whatever else, that if you're waiting for that next edition of Great Battles of the American Civil War, you're pissed off that it now got bumped back a quarter in the printing queue because Mystery Wizard just leapfrogged it. And so I get that if you're one of those people that's kind of pissed off, but while those are some of your hardcore fans, numerically, how many of them are there?
Right. Well, no, and this is something that Uwe Eicher talked about in another podcast, and he said, guys, it's a different level of magnitude.
Yeah,
I sold a lot of copies of Conflict of Heroes.
Yeah,
it's not even close to what he sold of 1812 and what is it, 1753.
Yeah, and the Vikings one, right?
Yes, right.
Because the thing with 1812 and 1753 and 1775, I mean, those are all a particular historical point that is well connected, and I'm betting that folks that have one probably have all of those. I may be one of the very few out there that only has one of those titles instead of multiples of them. But the Vikings one, you've got a definite crossover with the role, you know, the role playing geeks like we all grew up with, who want, you know, axes and swords and plundering and long ships and whatever, and are fine doing it on a tabletop and not necessarily having to make a role playing game out or role playing campaign out of it. And so there is a wider crossover appeal there that you're not necessarily going to get with one of the Birth of America series.
I know we don't have time for it tonight, but I want to start a fight the next time I show up at this joint. I want to start a real fight. I want to go through the entirety quickly of the P500 list, and I want people to count for me how many of these games are original, traditional war games.
7.
I want somebody to pick the over and under.
Yeah, I'll set the over under at 7.5.
So there you go, because that's what the NFL would say 6.5, but that's okay. We'll say 7.5. So we're next. Just put a pin in this, because the next time we get together, that's what I want to do, and I'll certainly, you know, accept a panel judgment as to whether or not some. But I think we should. I think we're all pretty smart people that hang out at the ACD Armchair Dragoons, and we got a pretty fair understanding of what a traditional war game is. And I want to see this number.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, we can certainly poke around at it a little. One of the other thoughts that I had on GMT that, you know, when I was saying, here's a couple of reactions to what you were saying. One of the real possibilities that I would not discount, although I don't think it's a primary motivation, is if I'm GMT, and I've got wargamers out there that are complaining that my local gaming store doesn't carry wargames at all, and so it's tough for people to see the wider wargaming hobby exist beyond the boundaries of the occasional game convention and ConSim World and places like ACD, that if I'm GMT and I can get Mystery Wizard into the store somewhere, well, then I can come back with Dominant Species or Leaping Lemmings. But then I can come back with A Distant Plane or Cuba Libre or Twilight Struggle and Imperial Struggle. And then I come back with the coin games. And then now I'm coming back and I'm going beyond the coin games, and let me bust out the fab games. Let me bust out some of the other simpler war games. Let me get Command and Colors, Napoleonics in there. Let me get CNC Ancients in there. And now I can start slowly helping that store owner support a wargaming audience with a company that they already know and like and trust, because they've been selling Mystery Wizard and Dominant Species and Urban Sprawl and whatever else. And the company gets a reputation for solid, high-quality games. You know, Thunder Alley's a great game. The dude that designed it's also the same dude that designed Maneuver.
Yes.
So it's not like we've got single-track design, you know, that Volko's the first designer to venture out like this.
You know, right.
Jeff and Carl have been doing this for a while. And nobody's going to tell you Maneuver's not a war game. And it very much is. And it's a great gateway game to move folks who are just starting to learn the concepts of wargaming into crunchier stuff. But again, Horgers are the same ones that designed Thunder Alley. And they're on, what, their sixth printing of Thunder Alley at this point?
Sounds right.
Probably about the sixth, not counting the expansion packs. They're on about their sixth printing of a NASCAR racing game, a NASCAR-style racing game, and Maneuver's on, what, its third printing? And the one expansion of Maneuver, I think, only ever got printed once. So, you know, it's tough to fault them for the way they're tackling this.
I said at the very beginning, and I've always said, that is a successful company, and I wish it to remain so.
Yes.
On a human level and also on a war game. But I can still sit here and go, hey.
I want my funny hats.
I wear square buttons and funny hats. Yes. With the square buttons and funny hats.
I will tell you that I did, in fact, check for the ability to register square buttons as a potential gaming website. And my wife pointed out that even among the insular world of the Grogs, that square buttons might have been too much of an inside joke.
We have pins.
Yes, but that doesn't make it less of an inside joke. So
no, I was always told growing up that if you had pins, you suddenly had a comprehensible group. I guess.
Yeah, well, we do, but that group has, you know, a very inside amount of its jokiness. So,
sure.
And the fact that Steven's been on this podcast for, you know, an hour now and has no idea what we're talking about with the square buttons just sort of reinforces all that. So
that's true.
Yeah, we shall explain later. So
I do like your interesting alternative approach as to, are they heading into a new market or is it a gateway game concept?
Yeah, well, I don't know that there's really a whole lot of people that are going to, you know, suddenly make the trip from Mystery Wizard straight to Great Battles of the American Civil War, right? Or any of the American Revolution series, right? They're not picking.
I just wrapped up a stimulating game of Mystery Wizard. Now somebody hand me GBAC Telpy.
Yeah. Now let's go play out the Siege of Pensacola. You know, that's not happening. Like, we know that's not happening. But can we move them from Mystery Wizard to Leaping Lemmings to Maneuver to, you know, to Command and Colors? Maybe there's a little more room to expand and explore there than we're giving people credit for. Jim, you mentioned, you know, things we want to talk about later at another time in the future. We need to have our discussion of the graying of the hobby. We need to come back around to that. We've done it before on other podcasts, but I have a brand new theory that's been developed over this past summer as to the fact that, yes, wargaming is an older hobby, and that's totally okay. We're going to cover this at a future date.
Awesome.
So we're approaching our hour mark. That's always been sort of our traditional break point. I think any longer than that, and people in D.C. can't get through it in one commute. I think an hour is about right for one DC commute. So that's our target, right? You know, how long does it take you to get from Lorton up to the Pentagon? And that's the length of our podcast. So, or from Herndon into the Pentagon. That's what we're shooting for there. which I think gets you about three exits down the 101 in L.A. I think that's roughly the same amount of time. So, that'll get you across Milwaukee and then some, won't it, Jim?
You could do laps.
So, yes, and as we're recording this, what's your prediction for tomorrow, Dodgers-Brewers?
For those who don't know, up here in Wisconsin, we have a restaurant chain called George Webb's. It's a greasy spoon that's unique to our area. And since I was a wee, wee boy many years ago, they've been predicting that the Milwaukee Brewers would win 12 games. In all the years of my life, they've only done it once, 1987. And when they do it, we get free burgers. Tomorrow, in that game, free burgers are on the line. This would be the Brewers' 12th consecutive win. My problem is they're sending Clayton Kershaw to the mound. And we're on fire. We're hot. We're a great team. But that son of a gun is a hell of a pitcher. I still think we win. But it's going to take every last bit of juice we got to get it done. I think we want this one just that bad, and we're coming off of an incredible run. This has been fun. Nobody expected the Brewers to be good this soon. We figured we're still 1 or 2 years out. And
yeah,
to watch Mr. Antanasio, who owns the team, push it all into the center, it's been a good time.
Yeah.
We'll be in full Brewers regalia all over the office tomorrow.
There you go. There you go. I'm going to be yelling at anybody I know that lives in Boston to suck it. I'm an Astros fan and I am greedy. I will admit, look, love them. I could take the Red Sox. I could leave the Red Sox. You've got an entire region of the country with a bad speech impediment up there. And I'm an Astros fan and I'm getting greedy, and that's totally fine with me. I care not. Give me another Astros title, for a team that, unlike most recent World Series champs, got better the next year. I'm happy to take it. And look, when your number three starter in the playoffs is anybody else's number one, you're doing okay. You know, so you know when your number four starter in the playoffs was only an all-star and not up for any real particular awards throughout his career, you're doing all right. So give me Astros over Red Sox anytime. Yeah, you know the TV networks are praying that it's not Houston and Milwaukee.
There was an individual, an announcer from ESPN on one of our local shows, who was asked by the local host, tell me something I don't know. Tell me some information I haven't heard. And the guy said one sentence, MLB is going to do everything in its power to make sure the Dodgers win.
Yeah.
Now, I don't know what that means. I mean, Does that mean the commissioner of baseball throws himself on the mound at some point?
Who knows?
Does he pull a Nancy Kerrigan on,
go kneecap Christian Yelich? Yeah.
Right. Does he go after Yelich? Go after Yelich's knees? You know, I don't, does he suddenly revisit Braun's drug testing from his MVP year?
Yeah, who knows?
You know, I don't even know what that means. But, look, there is no doubt that corporately, whatever they might do or not do, they desperately do not want a Houston-Milwaukee series.
Yeah. Well, so
especially when they could have a Boston-LA series.
Yes. I will also throw this out, however, that I think that if we do end up with a Houston-Milwaukee series, they need to trade leagues. I think Houston should become the National League rep, and Milwaukee should become the American League rep, as it should be, as it should have always been.
Put it back the way it was?
Yes, the way it was supposed to be before Bud Selig started dicking around with it all. Look, we had Christina Carl on a previous podcast and flat out asked, how pissed off should we be with Bud Selig that the Astros are in the American League? And even she said, you ought to be pretty mad. So... for those that don't know, she might be the only person out there who is both a war gamer and a baseball journalist. And we got her on the podcast because she was a war gamer, but we said, look, you're here. We're going to ask you a couple of baseball questions. And, sure. And so we did. And, so yeah, female war gamer, baseball journalist. We had a unicorn on the podcast. It was great. She was a great guest. We once baseball season's over, maybe we can get her back. Guys, it's been fun. Steven, thank you for giving up part of your Thursday evening to join us here. And
absolutely.
And Jim, it's not like we had really had to twist your arm to talk about games. So
I'm just gonna go back play games. So.
Not with the son, I hope. I hope it's bedtime already.
No, he's already come up, snuck up behind me, knowing Daddy was online, and went rapidly to bed.
Yes, there we go. So you and the wife can bust out Gloomhaven, and
there you go. Actually, as I line this up, I got to go on the radio and appear on a live Packer call-in show. So,
oh, well, you have some fun with that, and
I will.
We're gonna have to tell the story of the ridiculous, obscenely huge Broken Token Dice Tower another day.
Absolutely.
Cool. Steven, thank you for joining us. And Jim, thank you for joining us. And at some point, we'll actually give this podcast a name and go with it from there.
And it'll be great.
Sure. ArmchairDragoons.com. Come see us. Come hang out with us. Come join us for some fun.